Hello, everyone, and welcome to Good Areas Live. Here is the wagon wheel, and we are back for more. I feel like I was just on with B-Rum, the longest ever podcast we did last night, but I'm back again for more of this. If you're new to the wagon wheel, the best way to describe it is you ask questions about cricket and I mumble answers towards you. The best way to do that is via our supporters on Patreon. But if you are live in the YouTube chat, you can also do super chats while we're here. But on the Patreon, you certainly have the ability to get them in early, and you don't have to make sure that you are actually here live. And Mob King has done that. And he started with maybe one of the more random questions I've been asked in a while. In fact, I just had a look through my phone. There's some really, really random ones here. But he says, please rank the Bracewells by cricketing prowess as many as you can. Now, I know that my producer, Rockshoot, has played a blinder here. And he has six Bracewells ranked here. Sorry, he has six Bracewells listed, which I think is about right. I remember me and Jeremy Coney once were on air trying to remember all six names. I think Jeremy just got there at the end and I was really struggling. I would have John Bracewell, the off spinner, at number one. I think that he was a really, really good cricketer. And I think, sadly, his body started to fall apart just as he was bowling really well and would have gone on to be probably New Zealand's best spinner. I think he would have, I think he maybe had more natural talent than Dan Vettori. I don't know what their bowling averages are. Even if Dan Vettori was obviously very, very talented, but more as an all-rounder. I'd have John Bracewell at number one. I would have Doug Bracewell at number two, who's the big burly all-rounder, who had off-field issues, I think it's probably fair to say. I thought he was a wonderful cricketer, and I just don't think they ever got the most out of him, but I think he was fantastic. I would have the beast, Michael Bracewell, at number three. He could probably take over Doug Bracewell, certainly from a perspective of performance. I'm not sure he's a more talented cricketer, but certainly from a perspective of performance, I think he could do a lot better than him. And I don't know as much about the other Bracewells, the lesser Bracewells. So I don't know how to... I would have to go through the individual records of Douglas, Mark and Brendan, but purely, like, just a great New Zealand cricket family that has, you know, is very, very important and has been for a long period of time. Sam says... which author's books outside of cricket or even sport have influenced your approach to writing the most? Oh, that's a very good question. Probably when I was younger, and you kind of have the sort of people that you love as a teenager, I would say that Nick Cave and Trent Reznor were probably two people that were very important. So both musicians and the way that they wrote, certainly the very visual side. Like if you go back to a song like The Mercy Seat of Nick Cave, it's just so visual. And Trent Reznor, again, and I think there was a big part of that. You'd probably throw Tarantino in there as well. So they were probably, in that period of time, as I was coming through, were probably three of the more important ones. Luke Reinhardt would be another one as well. And then you would have the sort of the standard things that younger straight guys were reading back in those days. You know, Camus, Bukowski, those sorts of people. So I think those were probably the biggest influences on me from that perspective. But I read so many screenplays. So, great. I'm trying to think of the sorts of, you know, the great screenwriters. I would try and get there, especially there was, what was it? There was the scripts started coming online, right? So, you know, one after the other. And so, you know, I suppose Charlie Kaufman, William Goldman would be two off the top of my head. Shane Black would be another one. Nora Ephron. I'm trying to think of some of the older sort of ones. Oh, Francis Ford Coppola would be another one that would, you know, I would probably be looking at those sorts of people. Diablo Cody. So it was probably those sorts of things. And then maybe stand-up comedians. What would that have been? Maybe George Carlin, Franklin Ajay. I've talked about Franklin Ajay before, but he was probably the closest thing I had to a writing mentor. Incredibly important to me over a couple of chats that I had. Not the most famous comedian of all time, but, you know, just a genius. And, you know, I saw him live lots of times. So I think it was probably those sorts of people that probably influenced me the most. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else obvious. Oh, I mean, is it Sam? Yeah, Sam Peckinpah. So I kind of came to it kind of from music and everything else. I did read a lot of books, but I wouldn't say I was as influenced by books, maybe until I got a little bit older. And then I probably started to get in. But yeah, my writing style was always kind of different and flowed in a different pattern than many other people. So there were writers I met that I tried to sort of copy their style, but it didn't really work for me. And so what really worked for me as a writer was when I just started doing what came very natural to me. And my thing is that I was lucky enough to grow up in an environment where I had two incredible storytellers around me. So my nan was one, and she just had the ability to tell these stories that just kept you hooked. My friends would come over to listen to her stories, right? And there's another guy who's a family friend who we called Bonga Bonga. And again, he just had the ability. And I think I learnt that as much as anything was that sort of oral storytelling skill, which is probably why and that must have something to do with me being dyslexic as well. And so my combination is probably a combination, if you think about it, of screenwriting and sort of oral storytelling more than sort of straightforward writing. Connor says, what's your assessment of the Oman team? None of the 11 centrally contracted players who got pushed out have come back. The ODI results have been promising, but they've lost to some very poor T20 sides. Have the squad members even been paid from the last World Cup yet? I'm not 100%. I think some of them got paid, but I don't want to say that everyone's been paid because they probably haven't. Yeah, this is not the best team that Oman can put out. I think considering that, they've still played really, really good cricket, and we have to respect the players that have gone out there. But you look at the talent that they're putting out on the field at the moment, and you know that they've got more talent that they could be using, and it just feels like they're missing a trick here, right? They could be a much better team. So I think it's a really exciting time for Oman cricket. And, you know, they've done some great things in the past, but having this falling out with the players has caused some issues. And yeah, so as it currently stands, I still think that they could do a lot better. But this is one of those stick or twist moments. Can they just fix it and bring everyone back and make it right again? Or is it just going to be that sort of fractured system going ahead in the future? Hurd says, from yesterday's match, India's opening partnership showed two different, very different batters. One with eye-catching golf-style strokes and the other one was surgically piercing fields with high strike rate. Which one kept you relatively more engaged? I mean, I have always sort of gravitated towards that sort of Brendan McCullum, Adam Gilchrist, Vrinda Sehwag style of cricketer, right? Which is, you know, a little bit looser, a little bit more improvisation and everything else. Like, I think if you go through my career, Shahid Afridi, you know, whoever else that I've covered, I'm very interested in those kinds of players generally. So it's always going to be an Abhishek Sharma over a Shubman Gill. Like, as far as what I prefer to watch, because I think with Shubman Gill, I know what I'm going to get, right? And he might play something incredible, but I understand it. Whereas if you're watching McCullum or Abhishek Sharma, you don't even really truly understand how they're making that decision from that ball. Adityan says, people talked about how bowlers win your tournaments, except in his book, Nathan Lehman says, having a good bowling attack helps, but a more important factor is outscoring your opposition teams consistently. So he literally says, bowlers win you games and batters win you tournaments. How do you think about this? I don't remember that from his book. I think if you go through, I would believe it's the opposite of this. Because if you go through, and I think we've done this before, the ability to consistently make runs keeps you in games, right? But generally, having a weak bowler or a weak bowling attack is what can be the difference between, you know, winning a game and losing a game when it comes to those sort of clutch moments towards the end. So I would probably go the opposite, but he might have done more research on this. But the last time I looked into it, I think you can make a pretty strong correlation that if you've got the best bowling attack in a tournament, you're a genuine chance to win the tournament. And I think if you have the best batting lineup in the tournament, you're a genuine chance to probably make the finals. That was the last time I looked at it, and things might have changed. That particular team that Nathan Lehman was involved with were one team that didn't have the best bowling attack, right? So perhaps that's a little bit that he came up with a different style, but what they had was the ability to throw so many all-rounders at a situation. So if you look at Plunkett or Adil Rashid, maybe they could have found slightly better bowler than Plunkett. Well, they could have had Anderson or Broad. And with Adil Rashid, you could have had, you're getting your best spinner who also has some batting. That gives you an incredible flexibility to start with. Chris Wokes, incredible flexibility. Ben Stokes, Moeen Ali, like all this flexibility that they had built in there. So, I mean, the best team is that. But I'm not sure that that is just purely a batting side, because they're going into a game with six or seven bowling options as well. So it may not have the best bowling lineup, but it has a deeper bowling lineup and a more versatile bowling lineup than other teams. You know, they didn't even, in those days, didn't even need to use Joe Root that much. But if Moeen Ali was having a bad day, or if they had left-handers, and Joe Root obviously bowls really well to left-handers, and there were two of those in, they could have Moeen Ali at one end and Joe Root at the other end. So I would have thought that was as much important as everything else. But of course you have, but the whole idea is, if you can regularly outscore your team, at the other team, you're going to win a lot of games. But the opposite way of saying that is, if you can regularly hold a team to under par, you can also regularly win games, right? So I don't think it's quite that. But if you look at the history of cricket, generally, the better bowling teams have a pretty good record in winning tournaments. Oh, very done. The Brace Wells. PJ says, was is it Sek? I think it's Sek, isn't it? Sek Pepper, the greatest all-rounder who never was. What do you know about him? Yeah, I'm not like a Sek Pepper expert. He was certainly a player who was, talked up quite a bit. So in first class cricket, I'm just trying to bring up his numbers here. He has a batting average of 29 and a bowling average of 29. There was certainly he was a huge hitter of the ball. And I think he was one of the first Australian players who, had a, wrong-un. Because this is still the early days of the wrong-un and everything else. So I definitely think that there was certainly, that was a part of the kind of cricketer he was. But I think if you look at his numbers, it's hard to tell exactly how good he is. I think he is more an exciting cricketer. And there was a lot of feeling that we never, because I think he starts in first-class cricket. Oh, no, I got his era wrong. He wouldn't have been one of the first wrong-un bowlers, because you would have had Clarence Grimmett, Bill O'Reilly, and Arthur Maitley would have come through by that point. So he was very much of a period where Australia was picking those kinds of bowlers. Liked to hit the ball very hard, and I think certainly was a good cricketer. But if you look at his numbers, he doesn't quite pop. So we don't know how much of that is just because he missed his peak. But I think he was probably like an exciting player, because you've got a leg spinner who can spin the ball both ways, and he liked to give the ball a whack. But I'm just having a look now. 44 first class games, 100. Probably suggests he was handy with the bat, and that's and it would have gone down a little bit. But we certainly know that there were games in which he had a huge impact. So I wonder if he was one of those all-rounders that when it all came together, it was great. But yeah, I'm not an expert. Obviously, becomes more famous as an umpire, I suppose. More than anything else. But yeah, would have played Test cricket. I think it actually would have been a really weird one, because Australia had Chuck Fleetwood, Smith, Pepper, both on the outside, because they had O'Reilly and Grimmett. And so maybe, I think they had Colin McCool, didn't they? So he probably plays ahead of Colin McCool. Could Colin, this is where this podcast goes. Can Colin McCool, how good a bat was he? Are we saying he was a better bat? What's his first class record? Okay, so in first-class cricket, Colin McCool is averaging 27, so a little bit less than Pepper, and with a bat, 32. So, yeah, I think you would probably say that he's still getting, and he plays 14 tests, he's maybe still getting into the side. So Australia had a few sort of options like Pepper around at that time. Adityan says, any thoughts on the coastal contracts? The casual contracts that New Zealand cricketers have signed. Do you think New Zealand cricket can get Bolt back on a casual contract? I mean, that's obviously the plan. They've been really good over a long period of time at kind of keeping their players interested. And I think Trent Bolt was the first one where they kind of maybe went a little bit too far in the other direction and haven't quite nailed it in the way that they possibly should have. But you have to be flexible in this modern world. And I think that's what we're going to see. Was it 0-hour contracts for cricketers? Is probably the way to go. Making sure that they still have access to all the training facilities and everything else that they need, and that they're available for certain games. I think a lot of teams are going to have to, we're only going to see more of this. This is probably the future. I don't think it's I mean, it might be about getting Trent Boult to play. Although they could have picked Trent Boult, right? They've had options to go in and get him for certain situations where I think he would have been, where he might have said yes. He might not have said yes to all of them, but they could have picked him. But I think that's the future, right? It's that ability to move forward and actually basically say, we have to be flexible because the world has changed. And I think that's where New Zealand and all teams eventually, even it might even get down to India, right? Like if the IPL ends up being a 7 or 8 month tournament, like everything's going to change, right? Like it's going to be very different. So the further we go into the future, the more different it will be. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. All right, welcome back to A Wagon Wheel. Ellie says, what do you think the Mike Kesson's rationale is to play so many flawed all-rounders? Does it not begin to show diminishing returns if all of them have limited utility against only certain matchups? No, I can understand what he's trying to do. I think that, and he wouldn't be the first coach in the world that's ever believed this. He's probably thinking to himself, I can make these players better. I have a role for them. This is how they fit into the situation and everything else. But at the moment, it's a little bit flawed, right? Because they're not particularly, worthwhile or they're not ready. So he's probably playing a bunch of punts on cricketers that he thinks he can upskill. And he's trying to get the team ready. I don't mind the actual makeup of the squad. There were problems like Sam Ayoub should have been first drop, not opener. There are some issues within the team. But I understand what they were trying to do. They're just not very experienced. They're not quite up to the level, as you would say, at certain points. And I think a lot of their batters are a little bit more, they're very good against certain things and very poor against others. I think that's the same with their specialists, though. I don't think that's an all-rounder thing. Sashimi says, I want to hear a steel man argument for the overseas player limit in the IPL. I know you personally want to get rid of the overseas player limit, but what's the best arguments you have heard for keeping it? I'm not sure I have heard a great argument for keeping it. I mean, the best argument for keeping it is actually they're not quite fully using it at the moment, which would be if you go back and you look at American sports and the way that they sort of operate, and you can football probably fit in this as well, is that there's a huge amount of hype for young players, right? And so if you have a Suryavanshi coming through, right? We just saw the incredible explosion of hype and interest for a player like him. It's probably harder to pick players like that if you have, maybe you won't pick as many 17, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds. If you suddenly have access to, if you're picking between Suryavanshi and, let's say, Colin Munro still in, peak form, right? You'd probably be like, yeah, well, we need Suryavanshi on our list, but we actually want to play Colin Munro at the moment. And then in a couple of years, I think you could make an argument for that. It probably doesn't exactly follow, though, because maybe Suryavanshi is Luka Doncic, and then at that case, you're going to pick him anyway, right? Or he's going to be a star almost straight away anyway. So maybe that's a flawed way of looking at it, but maybe it's more for those that sort of next tier under, where you have a player who is very, very talented, but not quite ready, and you have to play them, and they're going to have one great game, and everyone's going to remember their one great game or whatever. So I suppose from that perspective, keeps older Indian players in the league, which again, if you are a nationalist and you want to see more Indian faces in that, it probably makes sense. But yeah, I don't know if any of those are steelman arguments. I mean, I don't think the arguments are very strong on that side. It's just that is what has always been done, so it's still being done. I'd be shocked if the future of this tournament is keeping four players overseas limit. Especially if you want to tell everyone it's the best league in the world, then just do it. But there are issues with making it open, I think obviously the BCCI and the IPL can get around them. But, you know, at the moment, they've made it very hard for other leagues to do the same. Drew Gale says, based on what you've seen of Tilak Varma, do you see him as a role player or a low-level star? He seems to get stuck against spin. Where would you rank him amongst Indian middle-order T20 batters? He's got a bit stuck against spin of recent times, but I think if you look at that side, I don't know if he has to particularly, you know, if you've got everyone around him can hit spin, and we have seen him hit spin before. He does get a little bit dot ball-y, which you're right. I think I probably see him as someone who can bat slightly higher up the order. Oh, actually, maybe Shreyas Iyer can still bat at four. I think he's a much better cricketer than Parag. Pattadar's the interesting one there. But is there an argument then, and I haven't got his numbers in front of me, but is there an argument that if he's one of the best hitters against pace, that it doesn't really matter if he gets stuck against spin occasionally, right? Because you've got someone that can come in. I still think he's a really good player. Maybe they do eventually bring in Iyer or Pattadar, right? But this is, I was talking about this last night on the podcast of like, you're making slight changes to a side. Like, there's no massive difference that is going to come from having one of those other guys in. There's strengths and weaknesses in both cases. I think he's a very, very talented player. I don't see any reason to get rid of him right at the moment. Reese says, what would you have as the best innings of all time? Everyone loves the Gooch 154. More recently, Stokes and Pereira get a good mention. Any underrated ones that you would mention? I've talked about this before. Sunil Gavaskar versus Pakistan, 1987. I think I was astounded going back and seeing the extended highlights of that. I think you'd have to look at some of the big knocks that people, especially Trumper, made on wet wickets when no one else could score. I think that's really, really hard. So those are some of the others. It's hard to go past the Stokes and Pereira ones just because of the situation that they were in. I'm trying to think of some others. But like, how do you compare Stokes and Pereira's innings to, say, is it Yunus Khan makes that big score in a huge fourth innings chase for Pakistan? Like, how do you kind of compare it to a guy who's so in control of the game that they don't even get close to losing it? Like, that's the kind of thing. And it's also with the ball moving around everywhere, right? So I think if you go through the history of the game, there's probably lots of those kinds of innings that have been forgotten. And if you're a top order batter, if the wickets don't keep falling, it doesn't get remembered as great. But maybe you're the one who changed I think of Ricky Ponting and Viv Richards as two guys who would sort of just come out and bat the way that they wanted to bat and completely reshape the game from that period on, right? And it's like, they're not going to get remembered as, like, I didn't watch enough of Viv, but I'm sure there are plenty of situations of that. But I've seen Ricky Ponting bat in those sorts of situations where I'm like, oh my God, like, that's absolutely wild batting when no one else can bat. And he's changed the game. And where, how do you compare that to, as I said, the Pereira Stokes kind of innings, right? Gooch is a very famous one. Alan Border in the West Indies when he makes that whole test match is absolutely wild. So yeah, there are plenty of situations like that. I've never done it. I know there's been books on it before. I don't know if it's something that's that easy. And when I've read about it, like, here's a perfect example. I'm sure this innings is in it, but Aravinda De Silva makes a big score against New Zealand in New Zealand when Sri Lanka were not a strong side, right? I'm going to look this up because it's fascinating. And I should know the actual score. Where are we? High scores in Test cricket. 267. Yeah, 267 at Wellington, right? So New Zealand get rolled for 174. Sri Lanka are 41 for 2. When De Silva comes in, and he makes 267 out of 497. Now, it's not the greatest bowling attack. Danny Morrison, obviously a very, very good bowler. Willie Watson, Chris Pringle, Grant Bradburn, but how does that rate? But also, and here's the other thing, clearly the pitch flattens out, because in the next innings, New Zealand come out to bat. Jones makes 186 and Martin Crowe makes 299, his highest score in Test cricket, right? And so when it was 41 for two, that all happens on day one, right? It still means that Aravinda De Silva had to come out on day two with a score at 41 for two. It's Sri Lankan team. What you got? Gurusinghe, Ranatunga, Hashan Tilakaratne. So not that's it. Like not a particularly strong Sri Lankan side. And he carries them when the ball's swinging at Wellington. I think it was quite a green wicket and everything else. How do you kind of work that out? Does that just mean that the pitch flattened out? Does it just mean that Aravinda De Silva was such a genius that he overcame that? I don't know how to answer that. And then where do you factor in the bowling? It wasn't like he did it against the greatest West Indies side, although he obviously played some great innings against Australia as well. But is there an element of that particular innings where you're like, you know, what year was that? That was before, that was in a period, yeah, 1991, like really early on, like within the first 10 years of Sri Lanka play. How does that factor compared to everything else? And I don't know the answer to that. Where do you put in Botham's knock, right? Which was, let's be honest, a little bit sloggy and lucky and everything else, like magnificent hitting, but he wasn't really thinking he was trying to win the game. He was just trying to get him back into it, right? Yeah, so how do you rank all these? And I don't know what the correct answer is. You know, I think in my book, I talk about the Kumar Sangakkara innings in against Australia and Hobart, which I think is a magnificent innings, but Sri Lanka don't win, right? And Kumar Sangakkara is given out, perhaps incorrectly, but given out. And so it's not remembered in the same way that Pereira and Stokes are. I've seen most of Pereira's innings. I was at Stokes's innings and I've seen it replayed all those times. And I've seen the Kumar innings quite a few times. I would say the Kumar one was better, purely he was much more in control. Like Ben Stokes was missing a long time. Pereira is a little bit more like Botham at certain periods, and so is Stokes. Whereas Sangakkara's was just, there was something, it was just something else. But it's not remembered. There's a Mark Waugh one as well in a fourth innings where I think he goes out and then maybe Ian Healy hits the winning runs or maybe one of the tail enders hits winning runs. Where again, I'm like, I still remember that innings. But because they don't stay not out to the end, it's not seen. Whereas, so you have this situation where the result then plays a big part. Or, you know, in the case of Graham Gooch does incredible things against West Indies. Alan Border does the same thing, but the English press aren't watching it, and they're the majority press. And the Australian press, it's very hard for Australians to actually watch what happens in the West Indies. And so when there is a magnificent innings played over there, it doesn't get the same sort of interest or whatever else you would say, buzz, right? And so, again, you have this weird situation where, you know, some of these things just don't, they just sort of fade away. And I don't know, that's the thing, I don't really know how to sort of process anything. But just, I'll just talk about that. So Australia were chasing 270, Mark Waugh makes 116, and the next highest score was 44, right? Matthew Elliott's 44. The bowling attack was Alan Donald, Brian McMillan, Hunter Cronier, Jack Scullis, and Paul Adams, right? Not peak South Africa, but very, very good bowling attack there without it. And in the fourth innings, with wickets regularly falling around him all the way, you know, towards the end, and Mark Waugh gets them to 258. If he gets that and he scores the extra 20 or 30 runs, right, and they win the game, where does that rank, right? And he's doing it with, what, 8 wickets down, 7 wickets down. But what if he chases it and they're 6 wickets down? Does that even get remembered as a great chase? That's kind of the way that I think it's really, really tough. Abhishek says, as a kid, Ian Bell always looked like a really dangerous batter to me, but was that just because he played against India at a certain time, or the numbers show a bigger story about his strengths and weaknesses? We did a big Ollie Pope piece and we had a whole section about Ian Bell and about KL Rahul. And we took it out just because the piece didn't need it. But well, we took out a lot of it. There might be still some mentions of Ian Bell. I can't remember if there's any about KL Rahul. But we took out a lot just because the piece didn't need it. But when you really go in, Ian Bell played in an incredibly strong batting era. Like one of the strongest ever. And his numbers are good, but his numbers aren't all that much different to Ollie Pope's. Right? Ollie Pope's done a similar kind of job in a much tougher batting era. And so it's fascinating to go through and have a look at these things and how they work and everything else. Ian Bell was very technically correct and he looked very good. I don't think he was always I don't think he was always brilliant at making runs when it wasn't working. And so he looked like he was on rails when he was in and he was set, and he would just continue to go until, you know, maybe he would have a bit of a brain fade and be dismissed before he goes on. But he would look on rails for about 40 or 50 runs. But if you go back and have a look, I think the days when he wasn't looking good, he just couldn't work out a way to kind of get through the start of his innings, which maybe is similar to Ollie Pope. So yeah, that I'm a big fan of Ian Bell, and I've you know been lucky enough to work with Bally a little bit over the years as well, and I really like him. I think he was a very good player, but I think he was a very good player in an era where the pitches were a little bit more flat, where runs were easier to score, and so maybe his record looks a little bit more inflated compared to where it could have been. Also, he's in a great batting lineup as well. Sam says, "What's the worst piece you've written since leaving Crickinfo?" Oh. It's a shame, because I was going to say one at Crickinfo. And why? Based on your opinion rather than other metrics. I don't know. I'm not very good at sort of remembering. There must be one that's a failure. Like as in, if I went back on it. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, Sam. But there's sometimes when I know what is a very good idea. And either it's rushed, or I didn't pull it off the way that I should have pulled it off. And that has left me frustrated. There's probably also just, a bunch of pieces that are a little bit more. When we were at Crickinfo, it was quite interesting. It was sort of at the period of where people were starting to do more listicles and, the subheadings. And I remember me and George were me and George are more narrative writers. We were really upset. And then when I got into it, I realized actually you could do incredible things with a subheading or sort of more of a listicle style, right? I don't think we at Crickinfo we did listicles in those days, but there was something to be said for doing that. And I still really should do more listicles, but I just haven't really gone back to that. But I remember with the subheading, and then when I left and went on my own, I think there were some times when I did it and I realized after a while I was writing them as a crutch and as a quick way of doing it rather than writing my best work. I'd have to go through all the Substack pieces. I'm sure there's some that I just didn't nail and didn't get in, And there were some that, especially early on, I didn't have any subs or anything, and you probably just need someone to come in and go, this doesn't make sense, whatever. So I'm sure there were lots of like little things like that, but I can't remember anything specifically that I have since Crickinfo. It's quite often though, when you write for like, the cricketer magazine ones I do, I'm trying to think. There must be like freelance articles that I would have written though that were pretty bad. Oh, actually, the worst stuff that we wrote was during the 2023 World Cup when we were writing gambling SEO pieces. They would have all been horrible, right? Like I'm just trying to go through and write as quickly as possible, trying to hit the SEO targets, try and put as much cricket knowledge as I can in, but as quickly as possible. They would probably be the worst thing I've written, actually, off the top of my head. I can't think of anything worse than I would have written. I probably rushed out a couple of Cricket 8 articles at times just because, I would have been during a tournament or something. So those are the ones. I wouldn't have thought there's anything that I'm massively unhappy about on Substack. But there might be pieces on Substack that I just know weren't as good as I could have written them. But I don't remember anything bad. The worst piece that I remember writing, I've written heaps of bads. But the one that really nags me, and I use in my sports writing course, which for those of you who've signed up, we are rejigging it and it will be up again shortly. The ones that are really, really bad have been the, the Afghanistan piece. Afghanistan playing England in 2016 World Cup. That piece still annoys me to this day. I can't think of many. I'm just much better at getting to the point that I want to do now than I probably was back in those days. James says, of all the bowlers who have breached 100 miles per hour, Tate Lee Akhtar were of a similar era. Was that they were truly faster than modern bowlers, or would that have been speed gun issues? Yeah, I think there is an element of speed gun there. I think it's also fair to say that Tate Lee, Akhtar, Jeff Thompson were ridiculously quick for their era. But the speed gun has changed quite a bit since then. And you know, it's changed since Geoff Thompson to Brett Lee's era is very different, right? Consider it, and again, it's changed quite a bit since then. So I would say we know a lot more. We know that the speed gun in that era really, really didn't help taller bowlers, for instance, which is, you know, is not the case anymore. And so little things like that obviously have changed, but I'm not an expert in speed guns. But yeah, I would say that that's very much something that has gone on when it comes to that. So I think the speed gun is just different and better than it used to be. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. Ian says, inspired by Curtis Camphor's catch today, is there anything better for a cricketer's highlights reel than an amazing catch? What is the best catch you have seen live? I was at the catch at the Big Bash where someone caught the ball in the boundary and then flung it like 20 or 30 meters away. That was just incredible. I'm trying to think of some of the others that I've seen. I've been to so much cricket, Ian. I'm not sure. It's a bit like asking me what the best ball I've seen live or the best shot I've seen live. Was it one of Ben Stokes's catches in the Stuart Broad one? That was some. I remember being at a first class game and seeing, I want to say, is it Ollie Rayner? Was that the off spinner? Took a one handed catch at slip that was just ridiculous. That was kind of past him and above his head. I don't know if we actually highlight catches enough, Ian. So I think you're right. It should be a bigger highlight for players, but I'm not sure it actually works out that way, which is a bit of a shame. It's funny how often I will see, you know, the best shots of a player, and I was like if you're doing a Ricky Ponting highlights, surely you would do the best shots, the best catches, the best runouts, right? But it's very rare. We don't really do that, at the moment. Will says, if you could create another regional cup along the lines of the Asia Cup, Which is the one that you would do or have the most fan interest? Which is the one you would think would have the most fan interest and most good in terms of developing cricket? Well, there should be a proper European league, right? Like that's Edinburgh Rocks. That it was a real shame. There's a couple of times, North Sea Oil tournament and then the Euro Slam or whatever it was called. Are the two that it's a real shame just haven't worked, right? And just haven't ended up existing properly or anything else. They would be incredible. I'm not sure there's... I mean, I think it would also be good... I don't know which other one would have fan interest. In cricket, you obviously have... in rugby, you obviously have like a big sort of New Zealand, South Africa, Australia kind of rivalry system, whatever you want to call it. You throw in Zimbabwe, Papua New Guinea. I don't know. Is there like a Southern Hemisphere kind of cup that you could have? I just don't know if any of them would work though. The European one probably would, just because I think it would help develop players and I think it would be really interesting going ahead. But yeah, I don't know. The Asia Cup basically exists because India play Pakistan. So I don't know. Can we come up with something else? What's another one? Teams with A in their names, cup, so that India and Pakistan can play more. Dinoy says, are there any adequate quirks? Why do I keep saying quirks? In a commentary box that the average cricket fan wouldn't know about. There's one that really annoys me now that we do video, which is you'll see on, if you ever see like the footage of commentary teams, you'll see people put their fingers up. And like fans are always like, oh, look at him. He's like a fan putting his finger up. And it's like, no, we're putting our fingers up because we want the commentator who's calling the ball to know that we also think that was out. But we can't interrupt them because they're in the middle of their flow. So we're giving them more information. So we might be like, that's out, that's down leg, that's high, all these sorts of things. Or, you know, he hit it. So if you ever watch a commentary session, you'll see lots of commentators do stuff like that, right? And that is... because the guy's in the middle of calling it, he's trying to call the action. He might not have even picked up some of that. You're giving him more. You're also giving him a little bit of color so he can come back to you and say something else. So there's things like that. Obviously, you have to stay quiet in the back of commentary boxes. Mics do pick up a lot of things. You should, I would say that's probably something else. It's a shared desk space. So leaving rubbish and coffee mugs and everything, I think, is it Neil Manthorpe? He gets really upset with John Norman for leaving coffee mugs. So John now actually intentionally does it sometimes. That was always a big one. Not making sure your guests don't stay too long. You know, that's a big thing. Like, I don't bring a lot of guests in because I'm, you know, writing and commentating. So I don't get a lot of spare time to just bring guests in. But when I do bring a guest in, it's like trying to get them back out, because the people who are in that commentary box are trying to watch the cricket or trying to do other work, right? So little things like that. The other thing is, I think, you know, really, if it is a sort of a bigger box where you've got lots of people, if you're at the back and you have information that the guys on air are not getting to, like, try and get it to them, but without taking away from the broadcast. So again, like, there are some people who just do this really poorly and, like, will almost just take your headphones off to say something. And it's like, it's all right, we're in the middle of our flow. Let me finish my flow. And then I'll set the headphone off. You tell me the thing and I'll decide whether it's interesting or not, and then go on with it, right? But yeah, I think that's probably the majority of it. It's, you know, there's some little things as well on commentary. So the big one is when commentators are feuding. Especially, this happens in radio. So in TV, if you see this in TV, it's not the same. But in radio, like, I've had commentators who've been upset with something I've said on air. And, like, they will set me up with what they know is a crap question that I either won't be able to answer or won't really do that much. And then put the microphone on and turn away from me. I put the microphone down and turn away from me. Like, literally trying to set me up to fail. That's probably, I think that's really poor. Like, if you're upset with someone, let's have a conversation about it on air. That's what we're here for, right? And I've had that a couple of times. Talking over each other, that's just a normal thing that should be part of commentary. So I don't think that's anything that is an issue. The only other thing I would say is, like, if you're coming on air, you should have 5 minutes of material in your brain to start your commentary stint. And I think it's quite poor when someone will come on and they've got nothing to say until the cricket starts, because then you're kind of leaving your co-host in a bad situation. There's probably some others as well that I can't think of. But yeah. Abhishek says, when projecting player performance in terms of strike rate, average boundary percentage, dot ball percentage, and NBSR. I don't know what NBSR is. How relevant is it to look at the venue and region-specific stats? For example, I'm predicting that the Asia Cup in UAE should focus mainly on UAE or traditional or regional splits. Or should that only be a smaller part? We don't do all the numbers you said before, obviously. But within true average, true strike rate, true wickets, everything else, we are factoring in the grounds that they play on. The competitions is interesting. We've looked at that before, and generally it still comes back to the grounds. So if you have a lower scoring league like the Bangladesh Premier League, right, it's more to do with the pitches than the competition. It's not like the whole league's like, we're just not going to play any shots, right? I wouldn't say that we disregard that, because you have to be aware of it, but it probably play a smaller part. Maybe in something like the IPL, where you have different regulations, you have to look at it a little bit more. But in general, we're not as interested in that side of things. But yeah, no, definitely the grounds play a big part in that. And, you know, what has happened in the grounds is something that we would look at quite a bit. Like, I don't know, if you play at the MCG, you were just going to hit less sixes than you are on other grounds, right? Like, that's just a part of it. And so if you don't factor things like that in, you can get too far behind. The pitch and the ground are so important in cricket. And if you're not looking at those, you're not really working. But there are plenty of stats that we have that do look at those as well. PJ says, Brett Shields retired in 1997, age 27, playing 9 tests in 5 years. Is that all? Wow. Mefedeko Nagam retired in 2001, age 21. His international career lasted less than a month, yeah. They both played 10 plus years of international cricket. Does this stunt the careers of Pollock, Antini, and the bowling around is such a close note? To me, Nagam is one of the saddest what-ifs. Could have played 10 years, him and Antini playing together, and a solid 6 years with them and Donald. Potentially a very scary attack. I think if Nagam comes through, because Antini... Let me just look at his numbers. I just don't think he gets the same runway, because I think they knew he was going to be a good bowler and he's got that incredible angle in. So he was very different to other South African bowlers. But he averages 35, 22, 47 in his first few years. So it's really that period from, what, after about 20 test matches where he has a good couple of years. He has one, he basically averages mid-20s from 2002 till 2008, right? With one bad year in the middle of all that. So the first 3 years are quite tough. And if you look at those years compared to when Nagam was coming through, which would be pretty much that exact period, if Nagam comes through and is just better, then he's going to get that spot, right? Because that's the, third/fourth seamer position, right? Third seamer position. So maybe occasionally Antini would come in, but with Callis, you probably don't need that, right? So that's one thing. I think he would have, with Pollock, I think you just play Pollock anyway because of the batting and the soot fielding. So Pollock, I don't think he's going to have any blips on that. I'd have to go back. When does Sean Pollock start his career? Would maybe be the interesting one there, right? Just on years. I would assume with Sean Pollock, he plays, where are we, 1995. Yes, yeah, so again, I think he's just playing as the second seamer, and so Schultz plays as the third seamer in that situation. So I don't think Schultz is affecting him. If Schultz and Nagam are playing, then I don't think Ntini can come in. But you have to play Pollock, and you have to play Donald. So maybe Schultz and Nagam, depending on what you want, right? You know, and what's working on the pitch, maybe they cannibalize each other a little bit. The more interesting question is the one about the all-rounders, because they really do push that sort of Klusner situation. I don't think you need Klusner in that kind of a lineup as much, right? Yeah, guys like Klusner, I don't think they're as important in that kind of situation with that kind of a bowling lineup. I'd have to go back and think about who all the third seamers are in that little period to have a look. But yeah, I think Ntini and Klusner are probably the two players that miss out, because McMillan doesn't miss out, right? And Pollock doesn't miss out, just because one's a frontline batter and one's a frontline bowler who can do lots of things. So I don't think there's any issue there. Hurt says, if you're rewriting the art of batting specifically for T20 cricket, will you name your chapters any different? What would the opening scene be this time compared to Bloodstained Grace in the Operation Theatre? The chapters would be very different. I think, you know, there would probably be something on strike rotation, which we talk about running between the wicket, but I'd probably look at strike rotation as a skill. Six hitting, there'd probably be something specifically on power play batting, maybe on death batting. You know, specialists against kinds of, you know, that sort of Tim David, Darren Sammy type of player. You know, different sorts of things in there. What would the opening scene of it be? Oh, I don't know. It might be something like one of Victor Trumper's beginnings. So we might actually start beyond T20 cricket to show that we always had this within us, but there were shibboleths and polite ways of looking at cricket, so we didn't use it. Right. Whereas actually, we always had the ability to do this. Ali says, Saif Assam bowling action. He runs from around the wicket but bowls with his right hand. Is that in any way efficient to transfer the weight of the body? It's obviously something we've seen a little bit. Well, Ashwin did it. Chahar did it. Is it Chahar? Yeah. It's from a biomechanical situation. Let me think about it. From a biomechanical situation, if I should be able to still get rotations through my hips coming from that angle, but they won't be the same as the sort of more traditional whip around, right? So a right arm bowler bowling over the wicket or a right arm bowler bowling around the wicket has the ability to sort of come in, lead with their left arm and then rotate the whole body around. Whereas if you're coming around from the other side, I think you should nullify that, but you will still get rotations. But how you can then angle it in is the tricky one. But if you're just trying to put, if you're not worried about the rotation, if that isn't your main skill or your hands are really talented or, you know, in Ashwin's case, or if you're just trying to come up with an angle that doesn't make sense to the batters, right? Or a run-up that doesn't make sense to the batters, is there a trade-off worth doing? Probably, but you know, maybe it'll mean less as more people do it. I don't know. Sashimi says, is the biggest selling point of the India-Pakistan game is that it's watched by complete normies and non-cricket fans like my mum. I don't know your mum, but yes. Does the lack of a quality contest really matter for the India-Pakistan game's profitability? Or if the gap becomes too wide, then even the normies might tune out. Yeah, so me and Bayram talked about this last night. So, yes, it is a game that I've talked about this a lot of. There are many cricket fans around the world who would consider themselves cricket fans, and that is probably the game they watch, right? Like, they don't really watch all that much else, but they probably still watch that game. And so whether they be casual or however you want to put that, that's the kind of cricket fan that they are. You know, you get the same in Ashes fans, right? There are people who just really watch the Ashes. So when a rivalry gets to that level, El Clasico, that sort of thing, that's what it does. It does pull in everyone because it becomes must-see TV. You know, what do they call it now? There's a specific name that they call it. Like, you know, that you know, you have to stop and watch what this thing is. Otherwise, you will be left behind. That's what that has. Me and Bayram talked about it yesterday of it's actually crucially important to the future of cricket because so much of the income is derived from this one game, right? So there is an element, without any doubt at all, of like, if the game gets crap, you're not going to make as much money from it. So let's say the exact gulf between these two teams just stays the same for 20 years. At what stage does this thing come out? And do the casual Indian fans go, it doesn't matter if we beat Pakistan anymore, we're so much better than Pakistan? Or does the geopolitics always trump that? Right? That's the other interesting thing. You know, it's really interesting to me that at the moment it's still such a big game, right? But India isn't battling Pakistan, right? India is battling China and the USA and Russia. That's the playing field that they are, I would argue, already on, but certainly going even more and more towards, you know, financially, politically, however you want to look at it. So what usually happens, and this is what is remarkable about the Ashes, but what usually happens is the relationships change between those two sides and those two countries. And like, I think I mentioned it with like Australia and New Zealand is a rivalry, right? But it's a much bigger deal in New Zealand than it is in Australia. And it's always going to be a much bigger deal in New Zealand than it is in Australia. Because New Zealand's a smaller country and that's their main rivalry. Whereas Australia has like two other, maybe even three other major rivalries, right? And so as the world goes forward and, you know, and Pakistan is just other than the population, right? And at the moment, probably the political structure or the structure or the business structure, right? And all these things can change. But let's just imagine they don't change. Well, then India's rivals are going to be China and America at the Olympics, aren't they? And that goes for the India-Australia game as well, by the way. So there is a world where that happens, but the fact that it's still there now maybe suggests that it won't. And then you have the England-Australia one, where England and Australia is a fascinating rivalry when you really break it down, because Australia is a part of India. Australia was a part of England and is obviously founded, in that way. And then you have a situation as the world goes forward of Australia becomes the better cricket team and sort of the pioneers in the way to play cricket. And so even though it's still a smaller country than England and will always remain a smaller country than England, and, you know, it has half the population of England, doesn't have the global relevance of England, you know, all these sorts of very basic things, English fans still really want to beat Australia far more than they do India or South Africa, right? Like, it's not even close. And so you don't have that sort of separation at any stage of those two. They just keep going, and people in Australia keep wanting to beat England, even as Australia becomes so much less involved with England, right? You know, the kids I grew up with, England wasn't their mother country. And that's happening more and more. You know, when I was a kid, most of the people I knew when they went overseas would just go to England. Almost none of them go to England anymore, right? Like, it's completely separated, but cricket, it hasn't. So I think that's a more remarkable one. So how does India-Pakistan go? I don't think we know, is the truth. But if it does have a drop-off, it has a big impact on cricket all around the world, right? It's so much of cricket's finances is tied into these two playing each other, right? Reece says, how much has English cricket actually learnt from the Azim Rafiq scandal? You obviously know George well, who was close to him. Did you speak to him much about it at the time? Yeah, we spoke a lot about him. We still do. I still think that there is there's certainly a reactionary part of it that is like, Azim Rafiq is not a good person and not a reliable witness, and so therefore it's not really a scandal. Whereas I would say that what Azim Rafiq said is the tip of the iceberg of what many different teams have been involved in. And so in trying to say, my wife, you know, works in these kinds of fields quite a lot as well. And she will always say, if you're looking for a perfect witness, they don't exist, right? Every witness is not perfect. You know, I think lawyers say similar things about, you know, in rape cases, right? Like if you're looking for like the nun who was raped by the creepy guy walking down the street, it's very, very rare. And generally it's, you know, it's a woman who does have lots of partners and everything else. And maybe does dress in a certain way. And then, so suddenly you're just like, so then you start blaming the witness. And it's like, well, it's not her fault she was raped. You do realize that it's the rapist's fault. And it's a bit the same with this of like, Azim Rafiq is not a perfect person and has admitted it and talked about it himself. So I think there's still a lot of people. And I remember at the time being told specifically that Yorkshire Cricket had like a dossier on stuff they were going to release about him. And this person was telling me that. And I said, why don't they just fix the issue? It's fine if they're angry that with Azim Rafiq. It's fine that if they can dispute some of the things. But to say there's no issue is just wrong. And I think that's the thing that has happened here. It's people trying to win this moment. Whereas actually, there was always a problem. I was writing about this in 2008. It was quite clear that there was an issue. I talked to a cricketer who basically said that Adil Rashid didn't have the right kind of attitude to play cricket. And he was insinuating as closely as he could that Asian kids weren't like the Western kids, right? I think we could say Adil Rashid's had a pretty good career, right? And Adil Rashid might not have actually got that directly himself, right? So I know he's talked about, you know, some of his stuff. But he has had to live in a world where very prominent people within English cricket were thinking that way about him, right? And that's not I could tell you heaps of situations, and I've covered them before, and I've written about them before, and they just weren't taken seriously. Now, they are taken seriously. So we're in a better situation within the structure of English cricket as it currently goes for these conversations to be heard and to be had. But it still is, and you know, remember, I've worked in English cricket and Scottish cricket. There is still a huge disconnect between different communities. And I think those people will be upset when you go that there is a structural racist issue here, because they think that you're calling everyone on the other side racist. And that's not what you're trying to say. What you're trying to say is that you've created like this complete separation between these two different sides. And that means that the minority people are always going to feel like outsiders. And so that is, I think, what English cricket didn't quite understand, right? If you've got 80% of your change room are white and you're making banterous jokes about white people from the Asian side, that's the minority talking back. But if you're doing it in the other direction, right, it's the majority talking down to the minority. And that's a very different situation. If you're thinking that Asian kids don't train as hard, right, without understanding that Asian kids live a completely different kind of structured lifestyle in many situations to what Western kids do, you're not understanding what the issue is. And I still think those things are definitely there. And I don't think they have gone away. But this also isn't a cricket thing. I think this is a thing right across the entire planet of whoever is the majority in any situation, right? And I've worked in places where random people have been majorities that, you know, would be minorities in everywhere else. Anywhere where people are the majority in that situation, they run the entire organization, club, you know, whatever it may be, group, in the way that makes the most sense to them. And we don't think about how everyone else needs to be handled. And then when you're called on that, you get very, very upset. And I think that's still the case from this whole incident. James says, do you know whether there have been many serious discussions at the ICC about extending test status to the Netherlands? No, I haven't heard anything along those lines. Wish I had more, but no. Not heard that. Sino says, having spent half my childhood in India and half in England, I noticed a stark difference in the quality of PE in school and the prevalence of sports culturally too, with England being far superior. Do you think this is one of the underlying reasons why India struggled to produce the sort of athletic specimen all-rounders that England, Australia, and South Africa produce? It's fascinating. I mean, you would probably, Sinoy, be more of an expert. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on Indian sport. I do think if you produce a monoculture, right, in sport, in any country, you probably are limiting yourself to the kind of athletes that you end up with because of that. So there's an argument for that in general. And I think if you look at India, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka, right, all different countries, obviously there's some overlap, but all different countries who have probably had such a fierce monoculture within their sport that they don't produce as many. Like, why, you know, I mean, Pakistan have been great at what? Hockey and squash. India, I've obviously had hockey. I'm trying to think, there's something else I'm missing that's obvious as well there. Sri Lanka, really cricket and what? Some of the shooting sports, I think, is the other one that Sri Lanka has been quite good at. There's no reason why these countries couldn't produce other great athletes in many different other formats, right? Like, it's just that it's hard within that system where everything is so cricket. You know, in England, there's all this talk about how much football is like the monoculture, but it's not. If you look at the sports pages, or, you know, my daughter's first PE lesson this year is hockey, right? Like, it's just not as dominant as you could see in some of those other places. So I think it's a fascinating thing you talk about PE. The one that I would note that I've talked to quite a lot is that something happens in South Africa, Australia, England, America, New Zealand that doesn't necessarily happen in a lot of the other countries around the world, right? It's that being a professional athlete becomes a job, right? Early. Australia and New Zealand maybe hold off a little bit longer, but there are plenty of people whose job it is to be professional athletes. And it's like this big boom. Like, America probably has it before anyone else, right? But England, again, has it. Maybe from the, what, when did the county players stop sort of having secondary jobs, right? 70s maybe? Australia is probably, what, the 80s? Actually, I might even take New Zealand out of this. But it becomes a thing that when you're growing up, like I grew up with a couple of Aussie Rules footballers who, you know, went on to have pretty good careers in the AFL. And they were, and a couple of other kids who didn't make it as well, that they were aiming, that was going to be their career path, right? They knew that they might not necessarily make it at the pro level, the same way that you or I may not think we become a writer or a lawyer or whatever. But they were like, this is the job that we're going to do, and we're going to prepare like expert, like professionals, and we're going to do it. And their family backed them. And I remember being in Hong Kong specifically and literally being told, it's not, being a professional athlete is not even seen as a job in Hong Kong. Right. And I grew up with lots of kids from different Asian backgrounds, you know, so Southeast Asia, subcontinental Asia, and their parents did not see being professional athletes as jobs. And I played with some really good young cricketers whose parents just weren't, they didn't push them at all. In fact, they made it almost impossible for them to play as much cricket as they needed to play, right? In order, and some of these guys were incredibly talented. And so I do think there is something within that that it's happened. And I don't know, you know, kind of how it happens, but in that sort of 70s, 80s through to 90s period, you know, you look at South Africa. South Africa has this incredible, like, sports science is like in and around Cape Town, and also the, you know, other versions around Johannesburg as well. Where it's so important, right? And they're so far ahead of the world. Australia in the 1980s, again, sports science, just incredible. And I wonder if it's as simple as something like that, where when I was growing up, there were probably, like, you know, probably 6 to 8 guys at my school at any one time who were on a track to be professional athletes, and their family was 100% backing them to do that, right? Not to the point of, like, don't study or anything, but, like, you know, guys who were, you know, their parents would drive them around, you know, they would get them personal coaches. And it wasn't to make them good at cricket or good at football or good at basketball or whatever it was. It was literally, this will change your life. This is your opportunity to go and play professionally. And you know, a lot of the kids I grew up with went on to play college basketball in America. You know, as I said, a couple of kids I grew up with, Aussie rules. A lot of kids didn't quite make it. You know, there was a kid who was a really good cricketer who lived around the corner from me who went on to be Australia's physio, right? So he never played for Australia. I don't even think he played for Victoria. But he was the great young cricketer who just didn't quite make it. And he goes on to be like this really important. So there's an industry, even when you don't make it. And I don't know if that seems to be a cultural thing within certain countries that hasn't always been there. And then if you don't have that monoculture of one sport, like there's the ability to change between sports. So I know another guy who was a footballer who was thinking he was going to go and play in the AFL. It didn't quite work. He didn't have the sort of fluidity to play in the AFL, but he was like 6'6" or 6'7" or whatever. And he ended up getting like a scholarship to go and play basketball somewhere else. So there was even a backup when you didn't make it, right? You know, Matthew Wade, Brad Hodge, both trying to make it as Aussie Rules footballer. Shane Warne trying to make it as an Aussie Rules footballer and then go back to another profession after. So I don't know. There's something to be said for that. There's also just on your general point of, you know, I very much believe in the sort of Roger Federer style of this of you should play as many sports as you can when you are young, because there are so many different things you can learn in all those sports that will help you as a person, mental health, understand life, understand business, understand being a professional, whatever it may be. And also the more sports you play, I think the more rounded you are as an athlete. And I think there's plenty of research that says that. There are some sports where that's probably not the case. You know, maybe the Tiger Woods one is a perfect example of that. But I think that, you know, that you could do that. And maybe in some of these other cultures, we don't have it. But I would assume it will come in everywhere, right? Like, I haven't spent as much time around, like, academies and stuff in India. I can't remember the last time I was in an academy in India. 2017, maybe? I'm trying to remember what year I was over there. Actually, I can't even remember when it was. But you were starting to see that come through. But it still felt a little bit more... I still felt that it was a little bit different to what you were seeing in other countries. So my guess is in the future you will get that. But if you don't also have a badminton academy and a hockey academy and an athletics academy and everything else, that's kind of what you're talking about with the sort of limited athleticism, right? But as this is the first generation really growing up who male and female within India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, where they even if they don't make it to the national team, they can actually be professionals without really needing a second job, right? I think I'm right in saying that. Whereas that probably happens, what, by the early 90s in Australia? You have a couple of guys who are half and half, obviously, but probably by the 90s, most cricketers who are coming through in Australia are full professionals, even if they're just shield players, right? They might own other businesses and still make other money, but they don't need to. It's just additional income. They're making money off that. The same with county players, right? And so once you get to that situation, that's just a job, right? And I think that's a very, very different situation than what we had before, where you needed benefactors, then you needed a second job, and you needed an employer who would allow you to play and, you know, who thought you were really good and everything else. So I think that it's just, and, you know, every different region is separate, right? Like, you know, in the West Indies, I've talked about this before, I think one of the reasons they got so good at cricket is because they were playing as professional cricketers in sometimes in two and three different leagues around the world, right? They're playing in the West Indies during their first class structure. They were quite often coming out and playing either league cricket or county cricket, and sometimes, you know, going between the two. They would sometimes get contracts within Australian club cricket as well. So that was also available to them. When Kerry Packer starts to pay them, they have that. They have the international stuff with the West Indies. And so you then have like a professional setup for young West Indians to be like, well, we can become professional cricketers and that can be our job. And we've seen the same with women's cricket around the world. There's a notable difference that we're starting to see in the sorts of people who are playing women's cricket. Before, they were all cricket nuts, right? They were like the biggest cricket fans. When I would talk to a women's cricketer when I first started my career, they would be like a Crick Info employee. Would like know everything that you needed to know about the game, right? Like just be incredible. And now, you know, having talked to some more modern, they don't know as much about the game because cricket is maybe their second or third favorite sport, but they're really good at it. And that's because there's jobs in it. And so once you professionalize from that point of view, you I think it does change. And it's harder to do that within Asia at the moment because, you know, maybe if you're a Pakistani javelin thrower, right? But there isn't a lot of money outside of probably cricket to make that money. You know, there's obviously a little bit in football, there's a little bit in kabaddi, everything else, right? But there's not a huge amount of money out there. So how many young people can actually say they're going to be professionals in any sport and so that they need to push themselves in many different ways? And so probably what you are getting in some of those countries is more Asian specialists who then look more athletically like cricketers, right? Rather than someone like Ben Stokes or Andrew Simons, you know, those sorts of guys, we're just like, well, they would have found any sport that they could have played and did play lots of different sports, right? You know, AB de Villiers and all these sorts of guys. You know, it's a very, very different situation because of that. So you've got the professionalism and then you've got that sort of monoculture. But who knows if that will continue, right? Like my guess is in all of the subcontinent, the other sports will actually rise. Like, I don't think they'll ever, well, certainly in the short term, they won't get anywhere near cricket, but I actually think that they will rise and change. And I'd be very surprised if that doesn't happen throughout the future, just because there'll be a knock-on effect from the professionalism of cricket and the industry of cricket. And eventually these things do come in. And I also think that will be, once you can see that so many people are making a career from sport, whether, you know, writing, content creation, coaching, physios, masseuses, all these different things, right? That didn't even exist. There weren't that many jobs for cricket writers before, right? There weren't that many jobs for sports masseuses in some of these places before. Once all of that comes in, it's an industry like anything else. And I think that will flow on and change things a little bit. But yeah, there's obviously a reason, and I don't really know why, of how these sports have developed differently in different parts of the world, right? You know, Australia and America are really interesting because they're both hyper-competitive sporting cultures, but one is completely school dominant and one is almost not school at all, right? Like the idea of you being excited to represent your basketball team at university is ridiculous. I never it's just not a thing that we would even think about, right? Like, we didn't even always try out for our school sporting teams. I had to be talked into playing in the school tennis team, right? Because I was like, I'm already playing tennis. Why would I want to go play this one-off tournament? And then they said, you'll get some time off from school. And I was like, now you're talking. I get this now. But you know what I mean? Like it wasn't the same. So you've got every country or every region or every different, you know, part of, you know, a sporting culture is going to be different. And there's something about the subcontinental Asian ones, it is very different than some of the other natures within cricket. If that has something to do with the athleticism that you see, I don't know. But I think all those little things do play a part in what ends up happening here. Whereas, like having spoken to a lot of Indian, Pakistani, Sri Lankan cricketers, Bangladeshi cricketers over the years, they are generally much more fans of cricket than the players from England and Australia and New Zealand and everywhere else. Like the cricket knowledge in those places is much higher, which suggests to me those are still people who want to play cricket and love cricket and then became really good at cricket, which is what I was talking about with the women's cricket before. Compared to, I've got friends who have been professional cricketers. They love playing the game, but it might not be in their top three sports and they're not, and they don't know that much. And you will say things to them and they'll be like shocked to hear them. They don't know anything about the sort of the culture of the game or anything like that. They just know about their sort of playing of it. And you know, so these are completely different sort of ways that people are coming in. As I said, a bit like what you see in two countries like America and Australia when it comes to sport. Anyway, that went long. We got a couple of super chats here. Of course, it helps if I get the other chat off the screen first. Couple of super chats here. Where are we here? Sambit says, as a huge admirer of your channel, I feel it would be great if you discuss more about women's cricket, like how you do men's cricket. We'd love to, man. We barely get to discuss men's cricket as much as we would want to as well at the moment. So we were looking at having a women's, show. Unfortunately, then Estelle had some issues and we hadn't really been able to bring it up. I still think we will probably have a women's show going into the future. what else would we have, Sam? But I'm trying to think of the next one. We've got some big pieces coming up on women's cricket shortly. I mean, we've got big plans for This Is a Network and everything else, where it would cover up women's cricket a lot more. We generally cover women's cricket around World Cups because we cover World Cups, right? So we covered the last Women's World Cup. We will cover a bit of this Women's World Cup coming up. You know, me and Estelle, we're both, I think Estelle's going to be out there. I was hoping to be out there. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to be out there at the moment. I would love to cover associate cricket more, Sam, but I would love to cover disability cricket more, right? First-class cricket more. I love first-class cricket. There's only so many hours in the day, and we don't have, you know, endless budget. You know, something like the Asia Cup, we've never even covered the Asia Cup before. We don't cover bilateral ODIs. So there's lots of things that we don't really cover all that much on this channel that obviously we would, right? And that's just how it goes. Sankop says, how much can an individual change the working of a board for the better, assuming they have brains, character, and will? Are there any specifics where they hold discretionary powers, where they can influence? I mean, if someone comes, I mean, Lalit Modi changes the BCCI massively, doesn't he? James Sutherland changes Cricket Australia massively. Warren Dutram at Ireland is another example off the top of my head. These are people who have come in with very strong views, or, you know, very strong methods or cult of personality, whatever you want it to be, and have changed things really quite drastically at times. So you can do that, but it's really hard to get in, right? And if you are too much of a disruptor or whatever, it's sometimes just getting in the door is the trickiest bit. So yeah, there's no doubt that you can have a big impact, and depending on the gig as well, you know, like, you'll see one of the more interesting ones over the last couple of years is when I first started, sort of the CEO was the most important person and everyone else was kind of like not that important. But the people who were involved with the rights issues have become, in some cases, more important than the CEOs in some of these places, or more influential, maybe, is the best way of putting it. If you've got really good relationships with all the people who are going to broadcast the cricket, it's like, yeah, I mean, that's huge. Member of Karthik Krishna Army. In the last innings, Wokes was batting with one hand. If he was hit by a bouncer, will the concussion sub bat with one hand as well? No, he would not have. Concussion sub would have come in, would have been, I don't even know who they would have picked. They might have had, the umpires might have made them pick a bowler, I suppose. Or if they had an all-rounder around, perhaps they would have come in. But yeah, it's like for like from that point of view. So yeah, if you do, and we've seen this before. We've seen players who have been injured already and then hit in the head. You know, what are you going to do? Let's say it's a wicketkeeper and you're replacing them with another wicketkeeper. What are you going to do, break the finger? because they had a broken finger and then they got concussion? I mean, there's no way of being able to do that. So no, 100% in that situation, it would have just been a replacement. That's it for me. Done. I will see you again on the other side. Please support us on Patreon. Support us, like, subscribe, share, hype. It's a hype function. A lot of changes coming to YouTube, actually. I think you can now watch some of our content in multiple languages, depending on which region you're in and how your YouTube works. But good luck to the AI for trying to translate me.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.